Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for February 14th, 2019. And yesterday, February 13th, I released my latest book. Now, every time I write a new book, I say this is going to be the last one. I cannot deal with this anymore because writing a book is one thing. Producing the book, getting it ready for publication, and putting everything in order so that it's clean when it goes out is another issue, because I don't have staff, I don't have people working, proofreading, or anything else. And so I have to write and then wait. Anybody that writes knows that you cannot proofread your own material. But when I'm dealing with something that's technical, and that really I'm the only person that I trust to really examine it closely, so I'm in a sense the only person I trust to really cross-examine my own work. And this is something I've been doing since I was young, because when I was in high school, I was writing my own geometry books. And I'd go into class, the other kids would laugh because the teacher didn't know what I was doing. And I always had hundreds on the test, and it was like, how does he do this, you know? So I've always been self-correcting. I had to, if you're out on the outer edge of research, etc., you have to learn to be self-correcting. In fact, it's something that should be taught in schools. For example, when I studied mathematics and physics, there's always two or three ways many times to solve a problem. And so you'd go about and these are complex problems, you know, physics problems, engineering problems, etc. So you go about it a different way, and then what you get sometimes are answers that might be a little bit different, but at least it's telling you you're in the right ballpark. And for example, a good example is when I did my study on the 2016 election fraud white paper, I had four different, completely different mathematical techniques of examining the voting after the votes were taken, called mathematical regression analysis. And I used four different mathematical regression techniques and came out with the very same answer. So that gives you confidence. And so I do that with my work. But anyway, the new release out yesterday is called Principles of Prime Numbers. Now, a lot of people might think, oh, no, a math book. I don't want to read that. Well, I'll tell you, you really probably do want to read it. And this book is written... took a bit of skill, but it's written for three different levels of basic mathematical prowess. The first level would be the average guy walking around the street, or, you know, somebody that's really not mathematically adept. You can read this and understand it and get that level of material out of it, and I highly recommend that you do. Then there's the second level, and that gets like a broad range. It's like almost like talking about the middle class, where you have some people that are mildly poor, and then you have people who are mildly wealthy and everything in between. And in mathematics is kind of like that too. People have all different levels of skills or, you know, basic understanding in mathematics. And then there's people, you start getting up into professional people who have actually taken, you know, graduate-level mathematics courses. I taught mathematics at the university level for many years, and I taught literally every mathematics course there is at the university level. I have taught at the university level. And so, and of course, to teach that, I had to take those courses as a student. And so I have basically a double major, mathematics and physics. But in all of these endeavors, I've always been what I call self-correcting, re-examining what I'm doing And part of that also is saying, well, gee, I didn't quite do this right in correcting things. When I was going through the final editing for this book, I found errors that I made a year earlier. Little notation errors, things like that. And I go, oh, this isn't right. This sub-indice is incorrect, or this something, you know, that, oh, no, that's not correct. And then I'd go back over it. And once I questioned myself on a table that I made of dealing with prime numbers, and I said, gee, that's not right. And I went in and I corrected it. And then I went back and I said, you know, my original numbers were correct. I had to recount, rethink, and go through, oh, yeah, that's right, this and this and this. So anyway, it's an ongoing process. But anyway, I am very, very proud of this book. This was a monumental effort, and it's volume one of a series that's going to come out. There was just no way I could get the volume of material that I've developed on prime numbers into a single volume. And so this one, it turns out to be a couple hundred pages, but also there's a lot of supporting material that really I could not get into the book. Because they're kind of big charts and tables and things like that. And to get the level of detail that I'm working, it's just no way you can get it onto a single page. These are big and a lot of detail, a lot of fine printing. And so I have other mechanisms for people who are buying the book to get this additional information. So anyway, I'm going to talk about some aspects of this book and a little bit of the history, and so to bring you up to date. Some people are familiar with my work. Maybe a few people are not, but I think it's good for everybody to have a good review of where this work comes from. And by the way, I've had two great interviews that you may want to listen to also. I'm not going to repeat what I talked about in those interviews. But the release of the book, I had planned for the John Moore Show, where I'm a guest every Wednesday morning. And a long time ago, John said in an interview one morning, he said, Jim, if you ever have a book release, I'd be honored if you would release it on my show. And I said, sure, that'd be great. So anyway, I remembered that. And when it came time to get ready to start releasing this book, I said, John, I got a book coming out. It's going to come out soon. And it's kind of like, you know, having a baby in a sense. I've never had a baby, so I can't really speak from experience. But I've known women who have had babies, and it's a process. I mean, this is every day is a new experience, whatever. And with a book, it's very similar. There's a different kind of pain. It's mental anguish that you're going through trying to. Deadlines are good, though. I got to say this. Deadlines are good. It pushes you because I could have gone another 3 or 4 months writing this book. But anyway, with all that said, the book is out. It's been released. The John Moore Show is the actual release. And then I had my monthly interview with the Power Hour with Daniel Brigman yesterday afternoon. So the February 13th John Moore Show on RBN, and I believe John's shows are on YouTube, and then the Power Hour with Daniel Brigman, I believe the archives are on their webpage, the Power Hour, and so February 13th. And those are great interviews. They were both 1 hour long and good interviews. Also, I have done quite a few shows. Now, dealing with prime numbers, when I did my paid cast, this past January was the month for Calculate Primes, which was my first prime number book dealing with prime numbers, and then Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. Calculate Primes was published in 2007. And there's quite a bit of history around that book. There's a lot of history, kind of a lot of intrigue regarding that book. And then, of course, the Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, I released that in 2014. That's about 5 years ago now, March. And then here, February 13th, 2019, volume one of basically what's going to be a pretty hefty set of volumes, volume one of Principles of Prime Numbers. But let's go back to the beginning of all this, about 2,500 years ago, with the Greeks. Now, if you understand the Greeks, the great cataclysm that took place on Earth, the Greeks that we know today, we know about, were descendants of the people that lived through that catastrophe. And we know this because when the Greeks were developing, they were developing their language and their culture and their thoughts and their philosophy. Solon was the great uncle of Aristotle, went back to Egypt to the priest cults that they knew existed there that went way back, their history. And so he went over there and basically asked, where did we come from? What's the story here? What's the history of the world, etc.? And they're the ones that told the Greeks that you were a great nation, a seafaring nation. This is before the great cataclysm where Venus came through the solar system, Venus the comet, and then it became the planet Venus, the Velikovsky story. The Mayans tell us this, the Chinese, the Tibetans, the Mayas, the Incas, the Aztecs. The modern Maya carry this story through, the modern Inca carry this story through. It's in their mythology, and worldwide we get this from the American Southwest. The Phoenix was the comet. In fact, remember, we saw a comet a number of years ago that was approaching the sun that I called it went Phoenix. In other words, it came out and blossomed out into that Phoenix shape, and I have a picture on my Pictures of the Day subpage that shows the comet and the thunderbird or phoenix of the indigenous people of the American Southwest. Okay, so that's getting a little bit off topic, but the Greeks understood then that they were developing a culture, and it was the sheep herders that were living up in the mountains in caves that that survived that great catastrophe, and then they became the Greeks. So they were rather bucolic, soft-spoken people, although they became rather warlike, but it was some of their neighbors, the Spartans, and some of the other ones who were much more warlike. But anyway, be that as it may, the Greeks developed, they spent a lot of time developing culture and mathematics. So anyway, a lot of mathematical development came from Euclid, the Pythagoreans, and other groups, and they developed a knowledge, the first basically theorems, etc., around numbers. They developed the Pythagorean theorem and proved it, that the a squared plus b squared equals c squared, the sides of the triangles. It's a little geometrical proof using squares and triangles. Very interesting, and they developed the concept of prime numbers because they would take whatever they're dealing with, apples or things, and they put them in rows and columns. But there were certain numbers, like say the number 11 or 19, you could only put the things in one column. You could not make a rectangle out of them. In other words, that's another way of saying they didn't have any factors. And so they posed the question. They realized that these were interesting numbers. They had a counting system, etc. And they realized that there was something special about these numbers. They called them primal numbers, so we call them prime numbers. But so the modern definition still holds, although I have changed the definition of prime numbers in my work. But the primal definition of prime numbers is that it's a number that if you take that many things, apples or oranges or eggs, and you try and put them in rows and columns, it can only be put in one column of, say, if it's 19, it's only one column with 19 things in that column. Or if it's 11, you could take the number 10 and you could have two rows and five deep, or you could have five rows and two deep. And so you could factor, you could divide them into rows and columns, but these other numbers, these prime numbers, you couldn't. So that's where the basic understanding the first definition of prime numbers came from. But then they said, well, how many are there of these? I mean, if you go out far enough, do they go away? And then all numbers after that are divisible, and have, you can put them in rows and columns, etc. And so they didn't know. So they came up with this ingenious proof by contradiction and induction. I talk about it in the book. I talk about it in the Calculate Primes book. And then I extend that proof, which, by the way, is many times misquoted by professional mathematicians. But the core of that proof is very interesting. But then I extend that proof in my book, the Principles of Prime Number book, to include some further thoughts. And those further thoughts give rise to some other questions that when you answer those questions, all of a sudden you start understanding certain things about the prime numbers. And so when I was in grade school, which was not as far back as the Greeks, but in the 1960s, the early 60s, I was in grade school, and then in the late 50s, etc., and then I was in high school. In the early to mid-60s, I was in college in the late 60s, but I was introduced to the prime number problem. In other words, how do you predict these prime numbers? What kind of order is there? And mathematicians throughout history have tried to understand these and failed. And I'll probably talk a little bit about this. I go into, there's some information in the book, some chapters, where I talk about modern mathematics and how they have failed to truly get a grip on these things called prime numbers. But what I discovered, and I talk about this and how this came about in my book, Calculate Primes, that I had been working on this problem all of my life, and I had been teaching university physics, mathematics. I had been working in industry and encryption. I had worked in the telecommunications industry, dealing with secure computing, with hardware and software design. I was a principal senior system engineer at a company where we built computers. And so I was involved in all of this material, and prime numbers would always come up because they had been used in encryption. They had been used in other algorithms and things like that. So these prime numbers would come up. So I always had an interest in it. And I, over the years, I studied what the great mathematicians, Gauss, Riemann, Cauchy, Euler, what these people had developed in terms of trying to get a handle on the prime numbers. And I realized one day that there was something missing here. And here I'm going to take a little segue, because when I was talking with Daniel Brigman yesterday in my interview, he was talking to me offline, and he said, how come I can come up with this stuff and other professional mathematicians, you know, tens of thousands of them literally have worked on this and could not crack this nut? And so I talked to him a little bit. He asked me, he said, are you spiritual? And he said, is there something, a spiritual relationship you have with nature or whatever? And basically, I said that I believe that one has to be spiritual, literally, not, I'm not talking about going to church on Sunday, that you have to be connected to nature, to the universe. And it's an interesting thing. When I was a kid, I was raised a Catholic, and I took a lot of it very seriously, including, for example, the part where fasting is something that's very important, because it slows your body functions down, for one, and all of the daily things that we go through when we're just living our normal daily life are distractions. And so as a youth, as I grew up and became more independent and I could drive a car and I could get away, etc., I started going out into the wilderness myself. And when I was a kid, a young kid, you know, in grade school, I would take my bow. I was always fond of archery. In fact, there was a point in my life where I had my own archery company. But be that as it may, I would take my bow as a kid and I'd walk out into the country and walk all day out into the country and walk around. So I got used to being out of doors and being independent by myself and how to take care of myself and then get back at night, etc. And my parents never questioned. They never thought anything of it. They just knew that I would go and I'd come back. And so anyway, then when I got older, I started going for a month at a time out into the wilderness. And I would catch fish and eat. I'd bring a small amount of food with me, but a lot of the time I would eat what I got out in the wilderness, or would not eat at all, or eat very little. And I would drink, and I would go to very pure places. I'm not going to say where, but up in the north country, let's put it that way, where the water's pure and everything in the forest is very pure. But I would spend sometimes a month. There was a time I spent almost 3 months out in the wilderness. And what that does is it connects you, your spiritual, your true spiritual self, because inside of every person out there, whether you think it or not, or whether you know it or not, you have a spirit that is inside working with you and working with your body. They're working together, hopefully. And there are some people who their spirit is not good. They're the flip side. They could become good, but they're marching down the wrong way, the road. Let's just put it that way. But anyway, these long periods of time taught me something. Not only was it in the northern woods and up in central Canada, or I would also spend time down in the jungles in Central South America and Mexico. And I would spend long periods of time by myself. I learned how to take care of myself. I learned how to... But the biggest thing was connecting your spiritual life. And it's something that takes time. People that live in a city, they're hustling and bustling and they're doing all this stuff and they're totally disconnected. And that's why you can have, say, big corporations or universities where people are there. And even if they take a sabbatical, it's not like they get away and really connect. So what I realized in my wanderings, and I always felt that somebody was directing me because of all of the amazing things that happened to me, and I've told some of these stories on the air before. I'm not going to go into them tonight, but to answer Daniel's question a bit more on this show, you have to study and go deeply into the subtleties of nature. You have to be connected spiritually and mentally. And also with yourself, you have to be self-disciplined. You have to, there's all kinds of things that come along with this. Responsibilities, self-responsibility, where you you take care of yourself and et cetera. I mean, it's just, and I've met people like this. And when I get into a room, when I say I meet a new person, and I get into a room with a person like that who's gone through this same set of personal experiences to get their mental and spiritual connection together with their surrounding, with their environment, with basically the universe, you might say. You can see it, you can feel it. You just by being in the same room with those people, it's just like, and I notice if people are around me or something, or and then I also notice that if I'm around people that are lazy and don't do anything and just, you know, play with their phone all day, it's like they start sucking the energy out of me because they're like a black hole for energy. They have nothing going on. They have no spiritual connection with anything. And I have to get away from those people. I literally cannot be in the same room with them, because they literally start sucking the energy out of me. I can just feel it. But at any rate, it's important to have a connection. And like I say, that's why entire companies, General Electric, engineers, and, you know, et cetera. And by the way, this is why I wrote my book, The Diamond Principle. It's a book that where I deal with this kind of mental attitude of man. We in the United States might be technologically advanced. We can build, say, although we haven't been doing very good, but, you know, we have the potential to build a space program and spaceships and rockets and technically, and everybody looks at them and goes, ooh, we have the ability to go into space. But let me tell you something. If you don't have the mental and spiritual aspects locked down, you're not going anywhere. You are not going to go anywhere, and that's what's going on in the United States. It's just profiteering. Heads of corporations, of aerospace companies, they don't go into space. They're there to make money. How many aerospace executives have volunteered to go into space? Not one. It's a money-making gig. That's what aerospace is. It's not about getting the human race into space. Anybody that tells you that is lying to you. It's about greasing their pockets and their bank accounts. Let me guarantee you that. Just like military. Anybody that tells you they're big on defense, no, they're big on their lining their pocketbooks with the big flow of money that's coming out of Washington, D.C. And so getting back to this idea of spiritual connection, it's very important to concentrate on this because without it, you don't go anyplace. Daniel also asked me, he said, he was asking about mathematics and understanding mathematics. And I never got this thought quite out. I think we had a commercial break or the end of the show or something. But I was talking about understanding mathematics. And I was talking about when I was growing up in grade school and in high school and in college, I was always at the top of my class in math and science and physics especially. And that's because I spent time on it. Other kids go home, they go, oh, it's 10 minutes, try and do the math problems. And they didn't make any connection to any physical reality problems. I would always, when I was doing mathematics, I would always take the equations and convert them into physical realities, like the equations of a pulley system or a balance or a ball rolling down a hill or whatever it was. You know, to have that physical association so that you could look at equations and see the physical nature. And sometimes series of equations might have two or three interpretations, one in electromagnetism, one in the physics of waves, one in the, you know, mechanical systems, etc. So all the more associations you make, the better you become as a physicist. And so what I'm saying, it's a lot of personal development. And all of this time, even if I was out in the jungle, even if I was up in the northern woods camping or in the mountains or wherever I might be, I would be in the back of my mind thinking about these problems. And the prime number problem was one that I thought about. It was something I really was going to, you know, very intently working on for my entire life. And then when I was back in the, I won't give an exact time, but there was a point at which I said, okay, I had studied all the great mathematicians' work. I had taught mathematical analysis. I knew about computing, computational analysis for discovering prime numbers, etc. But I said, there's something missing here. And so I said, I got to forget everything that I learned about prime numbers and what other mathematicians have done, what I've done, I have to forget all of this because somewhere, somehow, we're missing the main key here. The main ingredient is missing. There's a mathematical technique involved and also just some kind of new insight, some new tool. And so when I went away for a number of years. I didn't look at the prime number problem or anything like that. I just stayed away from it. And then one day, I felt like, you know, something clicked. And like I said, okay, so I sat down, and opened up the prime number table way out into the big prime numbers and started going around and looking at them, and that's when it dawned on me. That's when the solution just kind of dawned on me. And then I'll tell you another story. In the new book, Principles of Prime Numbers, it deals with tables. Now, the tables are a visualization tool to help you understand the generator function, which I defined in the Calculate Primes book. And so the tables are very visual, but I want to tell you where I came up with the idea for the tables. I was on a long flight. I was on an airplane. And I remember I was up in front of the wing on the right-hand side in the middle seat of three seats. That's where I was on the airplane. Not that that matters. But I remember the situation very distinctly. And I snoozed off, I dozed off, and I went into a deep sleep, but my mind was actively working on the prime numbers problem, and I had already developed the generator function. This is many years after the Calculate Primes book had been published. And I was developing new techniques, and all of a sudden, it's like it appeared in my dream, and it was not well-formed, like many times dreams are not well-formed, but when I woke up, it was that transition between the subconscious and conscious. And so I always have my pen and paper with me, so I started drawing and making examples of tables, and it just fell out. And it was like, here it is. Here's the visualization of the generator function. So the new number system came out. There's a brand new number system that's described in the book, which is very important because now prime numbers are the basis of the number system that I'm using. And remember that when you were taught about prime numbers in grade school, what they told you is that if you set up a multiplication table of all the numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and you put that on the horizontal axis, and then you put the vertical axis, you put the same numbers, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And then you, on the boxes associated with those rows and columns, you write the product in. That's the multiplication table, and we memorize that as grade school kids. You know, 7 times 4 equals 12 times 3 is, you know, and on and on and on. But all the numbers not in that table are the prime numbers. Well, what a ridiculous way to define something. Here's everything that we have, and anything that's not here are the prime numbers. It's really pretty stupid. But that's the way they've been teaching prime numbers. So what I realized is that the prime numbers are a number system all to themselves. And you can calculate the prime numbers using other prime numbers, something that nobody had ever done before. And so the new number system dropped out, the tables dropped out, but the idea for the number system I alluded to, I talked about it actually in the Calculate Primes book. But the tables came to me as I was dreaming, which I'd done many times in college, and in my studies, or if I was teaching a lot of times or working on an engineering problem, I would solve the problems in my sleep, and I'd wake up with a solution. That's why I always, from the time I was in grade school, high school, college, I always slept with a tablet and a pen ready for when I woke up to start writing if I had some solution that my subconscious was working on. And that was the case for the tables. And when you see the tables, now this is what I'm getting at. The tables are visual. A lot of people have trouble with mathematics because they don't have any visual representation of what you're talking about. Even mathematicians, they talk about prime numbers like, well, they're just seemingly random, like look like a bunch of random lottery numbers. That's one of the comments of a mathematician trying to describe the prime numbers. And so what I've done is taken all of the mystery out of the prime numbers, showing that they are a number system to themselves, and you can do all kinds of mathematics with just prime numbers. And so that's the innovation here that nobody had ever seen before. And once again, it took my belief. Now, historically, my belief that there was something simple but very subtle. And it turns out that in the mathematical proof of all of this, there's seven distinct parts. Each part is very essential, so it's rather complicated. But the end result is very simple. And any person can visualize, oh, that's how you do this. It's like any person can visualize taking a tire off a car, putting a jack there, jack the car up, take the lug nuts off, take the tire off, put the other tire back on, the new tire, put the lug nuts back on, tighten them, lower the car off the jack, and you can go. You know, if you can do that, you can understand prime numbers. It's that simple. It's that basic. And then what you do is you realize that you only need the prime numbers. You don't need all these other numbers. But what I've been talking about so far are just the basics. What's happened is over the many years, I'm working constantly on this problem. And so what I've developed is an entire mathematical system. So this is not just about adding and subtracting prime numbers. And a few new innovative ways of looking at prime numbers. It's an entire mathematical system with a complete mathematical structure. You can divide the prime numbers into groups, into mathematical groups, and that's a term in abstract algebra. A group is a mathematical structure. And so you can divide the prime numbers into specific groupings so that they form a group that have, these groups have certain mathematical properties. And so there's an entire mathematical construction here that's taking place. And out of that come some amazing results. And also, when somebody's working on something like this, I'm very familiar with the different types of proofs. Now, there's some outstanding problems in mathematics, and I'll list them here. One of them is called the twin prime conjecture. And it involves the following. Remember when the Greeks, there was a way they proved that there was an infinite number of prime numbers. But there are other structures in the primes called twin primes. In other words, 11 and 13 are twin primes. They differ by 2. 17 and 19, 29 and 31, etc. So there are these prime number pairs that differ by 2. Now, there's something that happens as you go out farther and farther and get to bigger and bigger prime numbers. Typically, the space between the prime numbers becomes bigger. That's something that's commonly known. So the question is, we know that there's an infinite number of prime numbers, but is there an infinite number of twin primes? Do they go away someplace? How do you analyze these? And so mathematicians have developed all kinds of probabilistic analysis. It's literally called mathematical analysis, in which they try and answer these questions, or at least get an inkling of an answer, something that can direct them to some level of understanding. But I taught mathematical analysis at the university level. I understand it. I can read the complex published papers, 40 or 50 page papers in mathematics. I can read those and understand what they're doing, etc. But I realized a long time ago that this would not answer the fundamentals of questions of prime numbers, like is there an infinite number of twin primes? Or gaps of 4. The gap is the measure between the prime numbers. So there are some prime numbers that differ by 4, like 13 and 17. The difference is 4, so that's a gap of 4. The question also arises, are there an infinite number of prime numbers that differ by 4, or by 6, or by 8, or by 10? It's always an even number. And so what's the structure of the primes? And so anyway, what I've developed are tools for looking at the prime numbers, and it's based on understanding them. Now, once you understand the prime numbers and you're calculating them in groups, all of a sudden the prime numbers take on mathematical properties. And you can use some of the very powerful mathematical proof techniques, such as contradiction, induction, and other types of mathematical proofs. And so I knew that this is where it had to go. I knew that you had to develop some type of mathematical structure where you could take a certain group of primes, say something about them, and then if you can prove that that implies that the next group of prime numbers will have that also, then you can start to work into a position where you can prove certain properties of prime numbers by induction and other using other mathematical techniques. So you have to get the structure first before you can use these various very powerful mathematical proof tools. So anyway, what I did is I developed tools. I knew that there was something that you would have to have new tools for working with the prime numbers, and that's something that simply was missing before. So when I went into the prime numbers and tried to understand them directly instead of through mathematical analysis, which was indirect, I knew that, you know, I was like a bird dog going down the trail hunting, that I knew I was on the trail, and I just kept following it and pushing on it. And when I came to roadblocks, I'd say, okay, here, I'm hitting a roadblock. I got to get through this. I got to get around it or over it or through it. I got to get through this mathematical restriction. And a lot of times it took a lot of pushing. And let me just give you an example that in this process of calculating prime numbers, you have to calculate some what are known as false primes in my work. In other words, you have to find these numbers that are not prime, but they're secondary steps to get to the prime numbers, and it's very important. Because without those, you actually would not be able to calculate the prime numbers in some cases. So it's very interesting. Like, for example, all perfect squares of prime numbers fit into that category. You need those numbers, which are very interesting. They have very interesting properties, to actually calculate directly prime numbers. So understanding these subtleties was very important in my work. So at any rate, I could go on and on. There's a lot of these are generalities and speaking in kind of broad brush terms. But what I'm trying to impress on you here is that this is not just about prime numbers. It's a very broad new set of mathematical techniques, etc. And so then the question comes, well, why don't I publish this in, say, a peer-reviewed journal? I have a chapter in the book explaining why I do not publish in peer-reviewed journals. And it's a long explanation. But it really turns out that, number one, you lose control of your work if you publish it in a peer-reviewed journal. And also, there's a real snobbiness in the mathematical world. It's called the NIH factor, not invented here. And so there's a long history to this, but basically peer review is a mutual admiration clubhouse for people who live in universities and live the university life. And there's a lot of personality worship that goes around with this, kind of like back in the Carl Sagan days. There are some Carl Sagans of mathematics who are worshipped, and it's kind of, they cannot do anything wrong. Everything they say is perfect. They're the smartest people, and you're supposed to worship them. Well, unfortunately, I don't. And I've had some run-ins with these people because typically they're either in computational mathematics using supercomputers or they're dealing with mathematical analysis and dealing with these probabilistic kind of way out in left field analysis types of attacks on problems where they're never going to get to the final solution. So what I'm doing is my work is completely different. It's completely devoid of anything they are doing. In fact, I did submit, in the fact, the appendix of my Calculate Primes book is a paper that I submitted a paper like that dealing with the prime number work to a journal. And it came back, and the referee that refereed the paper said there were not enough references. And so what a stupid thing to say about a paper that has a completely new technique for working with prime numbers. Why would I reference any of the garbage that's out there now? So you see, peer review is like a game. And it is. It's a game that if you play it right, if you play the university game, and they also have this attitude that only professors that publish regularly at large universities can be in the peer review club. And so you can see, it goes on and on and on, but I think you get the idea. So there are many reasons why I don't submit my work to peer review journals. And another big one is that real research does not get published in peer review journals. I worked for literally decades in research, building computers, building encryption systems. We built our own chips with instruction sets secure firewalls and hardware and software. And we built all of this, the very talented teams of engineers. And I was at the very top of these teams of design engineers, etc. And nobody ever published a paper in a peer-reviewed journal. Nobody ever did. And so there's this idea of peer review that, oh, it's got to be peer reviewed, it's a game. It's a silly game, and people play it, and they hope that when they say it, everybody else is supposed to jump up and down and say, ooh, peer review. Well, I peer review my own work. And when I put it out there, it will be examined, and people will find that it's correct. When I published my Calculate Primes book, I received calls myself from people that worked in industry, in secure computing, in the military industry, black ops programs, calling me, asking me how to fix encryption because they had been using prime numbers in encryption. So at any rate, I know that this went on in spite of high levels of denial amongst people in the industry. But this is getting off into somewhat esoteric topic of computer security, even though it affects you every day. If you order something online, or if you order something through your bank does a transfer. All of that is done through secure computing. Nothing is done today by hand anymore. It's all done by machine and credit cards and purchases and bank exchanges and, you know, et cetera. It's all computerized. And so all of this is done using what they claim is secure computing, using prime numbers, but it's not. And that's why you saw a number of years ago, still continuing today, there the organizations or servers, et cetera, are being hacked into because it's like child play. It's ridiculously simple to break into computers. It's not something I do. I'm too busy to do something juvenile like that. But it's very easy to do. And when I published my work, Calculate Primes, and then the follow-on book, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, it was to inform the public that these encryption systems are not safe. Don't waste your money on them. Don't let somebody con you into buying that, etc. And there's a whole nefarious industry surrounding that, not the least of which is the NSA, the CIA, etc., who are in control of that industry. So that's a whole, I'm not going to go into that tonight, but there again, if you want details on that whole story, read my book, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. In fact, before you read the current book, Principles of Prime Numbers, you should read those other two books. And so that's, in a sense, required reading. Because I don't, I just reread my book, Calculate Primes. Sometimes, you know, after a long time, I go back and actually read my own work. And that was really, really a very well-written book. Very detailed, not too much detail, but really well-written, where the conceptual ideas were put forth very clearly, etc. And so, of course, that's the basis for the current book. The ability to directly calculate primes, that was in 2007, and that was the public display of my work. A lot had gone on prior to the actual publication of that book. And I knew when I released that it would be recognized immediately by anybody doing encryption, that it would break the RSA codes. In fact, when I released the book on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, towards the end of that interview, a guy called in who called me the next day, actually, but he worked for a satellite company that was building military satellites. And one of his jobs was encryption on the satellites. And he called in and he said, does this mean that this will affect the RSA encryption codes? And on the air, I said, yes. Yeah, this means that they're broken. And everybody in that industry knew immediately that raised a tremendous issue with secure computing, because the RSA codes had been used literally every place in hardware and software. And so anyway, I just want to get back to, on my webpage, I had posted the myth of Sisyphus, the photo, and now I can explain what that is all about. I've got a few minutes left in this show. But basically, the myth of Sisyphus goes like this. And by the way, Albert Camus wrote a short story called The Myth of Sisyphus, dealing with the existential meaning of man. He was a existentialist philosopher who won a Nobel Prize for his work. And one of those works was called The Myth of Sisyphus, where he talks about the plight of man and the worthlessness of man's existence, etc. And anyway, that was very popular in long time ago. but anyway, here's how the myth of Sisyphus goes. Sisyphus was a king in Greece. And of course, this is mythology. Sisyphus was a very popular king. He was a young king, very progressive and successful, and his people were successful. And his queen, his wife, was beautiful, etc. Well, he died young, and he goes down to the underworld, and he wanted more time on earth. He was very into living, into life, into enjoying the things of planet Earth, etc. So he conned the god of the underworld, Hades, and said, look, if you just give me one more day, I'm going to go back. I got some stuff I got to take care of up there, kind of unfinished business. And if you just give me one more day, I'll come back and be fine with this death stuff, with being dead in the underworld. And so anyway, the god of the underworld agrees. But when Sisyphus gets back to Earth, he takes his wife and he escapes. And he goes and hides, and he lives until a ripe old age. But then when he finally does die, he goes down to Hades, and needless to say, the god of the underworld, you don't mess with the gods of the Greeks. They're going to get you somehow. So anyway, he said, okay, you want life? I'll give you eternal life. But your assignment is to roll this big boulder up the side of a mountain. And when it gets up to the top at the end of the day, the boulder's going to roll down the hill, and you're going to have to roll it up this hill the next day. And so that's going to be your meaningless lot in life for the rest of eternity. So anyway, that's the myth of Sisyphus. So I compare it to mathematicians who use three methods to find prime numbers. One is a sieve, which you remove multiples of certain numbers from a list of the complete list of numbers, and you are left with a small group of prime numbers. But the problem is it has no predictability. It doesn't tell you where the next one will be. And you're back to the original Greek problem of, gee, well, where are the next primes? Then you get to computational computing, which is using supercomputers to use, they use the definition of prime numbers, numbers that only have themselves and one as factors, and they use computational computing to find these big, big, big prime numbers. But when they do, in fact, most of the time they pick a number to try and find if it's prime, they fail. But once in a great while, they come along and they find one with great computational time on computers, supercomputers, or with the, it's called the GIMP, where they use public computers, people's own personal computers, and divide the work up. And now and then they will discover a prime number. But it's like the myth of Sisyphus, because that prime number, finding it doesn't tell them where the next one is going to be. It's an isolated prime number. It doesn't, they've missed many, many prime numbers up to that one. And so they get a 15 minutes of fame and maybe win a $50,000 award. And then they go back. And the difference, though, is that in the myth of Sisyphus, he had the same mountain that he had to push the rock up every day. In the case of computational computing, their mountain just got millions and millions of times higher because the next prime number is going to be very much bigger. And so one has an existential question about mathematics. Does it have any value? And the answer is no. Computational mathematics doesn't have any value. People are doing a myth of Sisyphus type of operation. Okay, so lastly comes mathematical analysis. It's a subject I taught at the university level. I understand it. I've read all the papers in this field. And they've come to the conclusion that prime numbers are random, or pseudo-random, as they say. Pseudo-random is kind of like the mathematical equivalent of the weatherman saying, it's going to be nice tomorrow or it's going to rain tomorrow. That's a nice way of saying they don't know. But at any rate, mathematical analysis spends infinite amount of time developing equations of probability and statistics around prime numbers, never dealing with prime numbers. But there again, an infinite amount of work and, as Shakespeare would say, much ado about nothing. But anyway, that's the mathematical world, and that's why I had the picture of the Sisyphus pushing the boulder up the mountain, because that's the status of the mathematical world. And that's what my work completely changes. It's a game changer, just like my wing generator is a game changer in the energy world. Just like my electric universe work is a game changer in the world of space science, astronomy, and astrophysics, the work I'm doing now is a game changer and will change the world of mathematics. Anyway, I hope this that you go out and buy the book, and it's especially for the kids. Remember that kids should be learning this. This is very important. Anyway, we'll talk to you next week. Go to the webpage. There's a sale. Remember, I have my new MR7 whole house water filters there on sale. So remember, go there to the webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.